My name's Carrie Klein, and you met my husband, Michael Klein, and I believe today's the 21st of April, 2011, and we're downstairs in the Concord Free Public Library. Would you introduce yourself?
Yes, I will. My name is Kenneth O'Donnell.
And your date of birth?
My date of birth is May 31st, 1949. I'm 61 years old.
Great. And tell us about your people and where you were raised.
Well, my family's originally from Massachusetts. I was raised in a number of places. I was born in Winchester, at Winchester Hospital. I've lived in a number of towns, mostly in Massachusetts, but I lived for a short time in Florida. I lived in the towns of North Reading, Newton, Woburn, Pompano Beach, Florida, Wilmington, Winchester, and Concord. And then I've lived in Littleton since 1986.
Wow. And what about your people? Talk about your people some too, the people around you growing up.
Okay. Well, my parents were both from, my father was from Medford, Massachusetts. My mother was from Somerville. And my dad was in World War II. He was a Marine in World War II, young Marine. He was 17 years old when he was in. Went to, right after Pearl Harbor. He was injured on, wounded on Iwo Jima. He was with the 4th Marine Division. And after the war, he knew my mother prior to the war. And they got married in late 40s, not quite, I think in 1947. My dad was a home builder. Different towns. Concord was one of his places where he built a lot of houses. My mother worked at different jobs at a hospital as a dietitian. And I have two sisters, an older sister and a younger sister, and we both live in the area. They both live in the area. One lives in Andover, the other one lives in Ayr. I have my wife, Susan. And I have three children. I have a son, Michael, who is 28 years old and 29 years old. He's a Lincoln firefighter, full-time firefighter. He's married, has one child. I have twins, Matthew and Rebecca. They are 24 years old, and they're both currently in college.
Wow. In all those different places, talk about your path to Littleton and then to working in Concord.
Okay, it's very interesting because we did jump around quite a bit. It had to do with my father's business. He was in the home building business. He worked for a company called Kelly Corporation right after the war, and that's where he kind of learned the trade, the building business trade he worked for. It was actually a relative of his. And they seemed to, my parents seemed to move to where they built houses, these companies. And eventually my dad went into business for himself. And along the way, he was also in business with his cousin. That's why the move to Florida in the early 50s. I was in first grade when we moved there. And we moved to Pompano Beach, Florida. And his cousin was in the building business. He was older than my dad. And they built in the Fort Lauderdale, Pompano Beach area, Deerfield. And it was a lot different back then, South Florida, than it is today. It was much smaller, much quieter, and it was many years since I went back there, and I couldn't get over the changes in those towns. It just the growth was just phenomenal. When we lived there, it was very, very low key and small, and a lot different than it is now. And so, as he progressed in the building business, we moved around, and he eventually bought some land in Concord, and we lived on Dalton Road, right off of Old Bedford Road in Concord. We actually lived on the same street that he built. It's right near the McHugh land and the land that Bill Kenny farms. It's right in that area. And so that's what kind of gave our connection to Concord. And I liked it right from the beginning. And I decided back then that I would try to work in the area and try to settle down here.
Why did he pick Concord?
Well, as a child, his family used to come up to Concord a lot for the the parades around this time of the year, 18th of April and all that, and he liked it then, and it was sort of, I guess, the same reason that I decided. He liked the area, and he wanted to stay here.
You were what age when you came?
To Concord? 18.
Can you see these, Michael?
I don't have.
18. So what was Concord like then?
Well, it was different. It was still... I remember Lawrence Kenny, the first winter we spent there, plowed our sidewalks on Dalton Road with a horse and a walk-behind plow. And it was just amazing to see that. And he did that, I guess, in different parts of the town. That's, of course, that's Bill Kenny's dad. And I knew Lawrence Kenny. He lived right around the corner from us, basically. And the McHughes, they were the, I think there were three brothers, all single men, and they farmed that land near Lawrence Kenny's farm. And they use a horse and plow, too. They may have had a mechanical tractor, but they did use a horse, and I recall them walking behind a horse, plowing the fields.
McHugh. Do you know how to spell that?
I believe it's M-C-H-U-G-H. Their homestead was on the corner of, well, it was on Lexington Road, right near Old Bedford, but it was definitely on Lexington Road. And I believe... there was three boys. There may have been their sister lived in the house also. And I think they were Irish immigrants. But they were quite elderly even back then in the late 60s. But they got out there and worked every day. I mean, it was very interesting to see them.
Did you have many interactions with them?
No, not really. I knew who they were. They didn't really know me, but because our road was right near where they farmed, we saw them all the time. It was pretty frequent to see them.
Who were the other older folks around town then?
Well, let's see. I remember, I didn't know them. I wasn't a Concord native, but I remember the Emersons were around, the folks that lived up on... Monument Street, and I knew people who knew them. One of the captains in the fire department, Bob Robinson, lived in a log cabin on their property way out back. I had the occasion to see it one time during a call, but when he was first married, he and his wife, Ellie, lived in this log cabin. It was behind the main house on Monument Street, quite a ways behind it into the woods. And he told me that this log cabin was built in Minnesota, disassembled and brought to Concord and reassembled and put on the property. And as it happened, one day we had a problem up there in this log cabin. The Robinsons weren't living. There was another tenant. They had a chimney fire and didn't do any damage, but I was able to finally see what this cabin looked like. And it was very interesting. It was a very authentic cabin and, quite old. So that was another memory I had of way back when.
Do you remember it in any kind of detail?
Well, we weren't there that long. I just remember going in. It was a wood stove, and it wasn't working right. It was smoky, and they got concerned about it. And my captain at the time was Bob Robinson, and he was the one that actually lived in the house. He was familiar with it. So, but it was a nice. Nice rustic building. It wasn't, it wasn't fancy, but it was pretty nice all the same time too.
Old chinking.
I'm sorry.
Old chinking.
Yes. And some of the other things.
Which Emerson? I'm sorry. Which Emerson family was that?
Well, I know I know they were ancestors of Ralph Waldo Emerson, I believe. And the woman that lived there, she volunteered for years at Emerson Hospital.
Remember her name?
Mrs. I don't know the first name, no. But I know what she looked like. I remember seeing her because my wife was a nurse at the hospital and she knew who she was.
Mrs., you were starting to say her last name?
Emerson. That's her name. I don't know her first name.
Who were the other? Remember any other old-timers?
Well, let me think. Well, not going way, way back, but just my in-laws. They moved to Concord in the 30s. My in-laws are both still alive. My father-in-law, John O'Neill, is in a nursing home. He's at Concord Healthcare.
John O'Neill.
And Constance O'Neill.
Spelled. The O'Neill is spelled?
O'Neill. He has Alzheimer's now. He was the superintendent of the Concord Municipal Light Plant. He's been retired. Now he's 85. He was retired when he was 62. But he recalls moving to Concord. He lived in Boston. He took the noontime train out of North Station, and they got off at West Concord, and was with his mother, and his mother had a cat in a basket, and his dad, the reason they moved is his dad was a correctional officer at the prison. And so they moved here on the noontime train, and they lived right in a house right on Commonwealth Avenue, right near the Pale Factory Bridge, which is still there today. And they moved... He met his wife, Constance Payne. She lived on Lawsbrook Road. She moved in 1938, the year of the hurricane. They met, and it's very interesting. They never really either of them moved very far away. They got married. They lived on Commonwealth Avenue, and at one house they rented, and then they bought a house on Commonwealth Avenue. They sold that about 24 years ago, and they moved right around the corner on Lawsbrook Road. So by the time they first moved to Concord, they didn't basically move more than a quarter of a mile away. And so that's one of those things. They West Concord was their home. I mean, it's... and they haven't, other than in the facilities they're in now, they never really moved more than a quarter of a mile from where they first set foot. It's kind of interesting.
Moved on the noontime train.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Furniture?
I don't think so. I'm not sure how they, what they brought and what they have. You know, things were simpler then. But that's how they moved. Yeah.
Cat in the basket.
I wish I remember the cat's name, but I don't. But as far as the old time, not being a Concord native, I didn't know that many people. Once I joined the fire department in 1976 as a call firefighter, I got to know more people in town. And back in the early 1976, when I joined the fire department as a call firefighter, we had many more call firefighters. We only have one left now because we're all permanent.
Firefighters?
It's like a volunteer. It's like they assisted the full-time firefighters. And they had they have the two state fire stations in town. And they're back in the 40s and 50s, they had a lot of call firefighters. But when I first came on, we had about 10. We had about 5 assigned to each station. And then over time, we were always a full-time fire department, at least when I joined. They eventually, as they retired or moved on, they didn't replace them. We have one call firefighter now. His name is Keith Nelms.
Nelms,
N-E-L-M-S, Keith Nelms. He works for the Concord School Department, and he's a call firefighter. He's a great guy. But a lot of the old Concord firefighters have passed on, the full-timers and the call firefighters. But there's still some of the regulars that are still around. Howie Soberg.
Soberg?
Yes, S-O-B-E-R-G, Howard Soberg. Probably a name that you've heard off of Jack Chisholm. He's a retired full-time firefighter. Jack is very knowledgeable about Concord and its history. Extremely knowledgeable. And Ed Curran. Stanley Orpik. O-R-P-I-K. He was my captain when I first came on the job. He's still around. He's 85 years old. Chief Cullinane, Matthew Cullinane, he's in his late 80s. He's still alive. Dick Ryan, he was a fire chief. He's still around. There's quite a few that are still here.
Sounds like you could mount a whole oral history project just on the fire or something.
I really could, and a lot of it is I learned from Jack Chisholm, and I have an interest in it because we do, myself and another firefighter, Roddy Lloyd, do the cemetery flags every Memorial Day, and we go around and we place a firefighter flag at each grave. We have a special marker that we've had made up. It's a bronze marker. It's a nice ornamental marker. We put the firefighter's flag in there, and we have about 60 graves now. We put flags in, and interestingly enough, the oldest piece of historic artifact at the fire department is a big sign called Independence Court. Independence. It was one of the fire stations, and we have that sign at the station. It's about as long as this table, so I'd say roughly 8 to 10 feet long, and it was placed over the fire station on Independence Court. It was built by Rufus Hosmer, who was also a volunteer fireman in those days. It was 1851, the sign.
Hosmer?
Hosmer, H-O-S-M-E-R. That's a Concord name. We found his grave last year up at the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery, and we've put a marker there. I didn't know whether he was a firefighter or not, and Jack Chisholm, who has a lot of knowledge, looked up on his records. He said, yes, Rufus Hosmer was a fireman. So we put a plaque on his grave and a flag.
And some of the 60, I suppose you knew.
I'm sorry?
Some of the 60 you knew, I suppose.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, some of them I did. A lot of the graves are, people that were there before I came, and there's quite a few I do know, I knew of.
Well, talk about your own path to being a firefighter.
Well, it was kind of an interesting path. When I first moved to Concord, I had an interest in the fire service. I went to Boston College, and I worked with my dad for a few years in the building business, and then I didn't want to stay in that type of business, so I took a job at the First National Bank in Boston. I worked in the trust division, of all things. I was in trust and estate administration, and interesting work. I knew it wasn't for me eventually. But I got to know some people, a couple of the call firefighters, the younger guys that were about my age, and I joined the call department in Concord, and I got to really like it. So I decided this is the career path I'd follow, and I took 2 or 3 tests, and I eventually got appointed full-time. And so it was quite a career change, but I'm glad I did it, and It's been a nice career. I've enjoyed it. So that's how I found my way into the fire department.
Wow. Well, I don't want to guide you too tightly if you brought a whole sheet of things that are on your mind to talk about regard to it.
Yeah, the most of my notes here are about the fire department. With regard to the changes, as I mentioned earlier, we had many call firefighters in the 1970s. They were assigned to both stations. We still have 2 fire stations in town, one on West Concord and on Main Street, and one on Wallet Street in Concord. There was a study done when I first came on full-time about if these stations were located in the proper places, and as it turned out, they based it on where our runs are, and I remember that one of the deputies at the time, Ted Finan, who's still around, said they couldn't pick 2 better spots for the fire station. So as far as location, they're still there. They're in the right places. The West Concord Fire Station, built in 1932, ironically, it was replaced because the fire station that it replaced burned down that year, 1932. It was a wood frame station. And it was a very windy fall day, I guess. And I'm not sure how the fire started, but it started in the fire station. didn't, but it spread to other buildings right around the Harvey Wheeler Center and Church Street. And I guess the firemen were out. They were out at a fire in Lincoln at the time, so there was nobody in the station. But the station was totally destroyed, and the other area towns came to help, you know, extinguish it. But so that's the station in West Carquinez was built in 1932, very shortly afterwards. And the station down here on Walden Street was built in 1960 to replace an earlier station. On Walden Street also was where the there's a restaurant. I'm not sure the name of the restaurant, but it's a restaurant, and there's a another occupancy in there. I believe it's a salon. But there's been a lot of changes in the fire department. The equipment, the apparatus. When I first came over, open cab trucks. They were smaller. They weren't as sophisticated as the ones now. The trucks now are, they're closed cabs, they're air conditioned, they carry a lot more equipment, more sophisticated equipment. I remember when I first came on, we rode on the back step of the truck. We had like a little belt we just tied on around our waist to the back bar. That's totally unacceptable now. It's not done anymore. That was so dangerous. But now we can't even, the truck can't even, we have to be seat belted. If we don't have our seat belts on, warning lights go off because of your weight on the seat. So there's many more safety features. The equipment is far more sophisticated now. We have better air packs. We have thermal images to find, you know, people or firefighters that are down. The advances in the equipment in the last 30 years has been tremendous. One of the biggest things is a result of the Worcester fire in 1999, where they lost 6 firefighters. So the thermal imaging cameras, every fire department has a thermal imaging camera. We have 3 or 4 in Concord. And one of the problems in that fire, one of the tragic problems, was they couldn't find the firefighters right away. And I happened to go up there with the fire chief the morning after it happened. He was part of a task force that went up there, Fire Chief Joe Lennox. And, they were just manually digging for them. I think if they had had thermal images, then they would have found the firefighters sooner. They did eventually, of course, find them.
How does that work?
Well, it's it looks like a video camera, and you hold it, and I'm not sure of the technology, but it's an infrared a process that seeks heat. If I put my hand on the wall of this room that we're in, I could use this camera and hold it, and it will show a white outline with my heat from my hand that's retained. So if there's somebody is, you know, underneath some rubble or something like that, you can see their body heat, and it can be used for not just finding people. It can find people, but if there's a fire behind a wall and it's not visible, you can point the camera towards the wall. If you suspect fire behind the wall, there's this bright white light that shows up. It's the heat is shown as a bright white image on the camera. And those cameras have become more technically advanced than they were even 15 years ago. So the equipment in the fire service is constantly being updated. Our turnout gear is way better. We had rubber coats when I first started. Now it's a highly advanced fabric made of Kevlar and Nomex. They've done studies, and they're improving it all the time.
So you're in a burning building. You're looking for bodies, and you're holding this camera walking around?
Yeah, well, if you're usually on your hands and knees, but if we suspect somebody's in there, you can, this will help you find it. As far as down firefighters, if somebody's trapped and we can't move, we have a device called a PASS device that's integrated to our air packs. If we stop moving because we're injured and we can't move, once you don't move anymore, this mechanism on your air pack will start to alarm. And as soon as you move, it will stop. But if you're not moving, it will graduates into higher and higher alarms. It's an ear-piercing noise, so we know where people are. So that's another advancement in the fire service.
Have you experienced that?
No, I haven't. I really haven't. So fortunately, I haven't done it. We train. You know, we if we have a situation where we can put one of us in there, and we'll hide them in a building if we can train. We have them stop moving, and then this alarm will go off. But as soon as you turn your air pack on and go into a burning building, this pass device is a it's activated
until you turn. Pass P.
Yes, PASS. It's
PASS.
PASS. It's I think the acronym is personal safety. Personal. I'm not sure what the A is. It's safety system though. It's a pass device. It's a, one of the other things. As far the fire department in Concord does the medical emergencies. The ambulances have become more advanced. When I first came on, we had a Cadillac ambulance, sort of like what a hearse looks like. They've advanced to modular type ambulances. They're bigger. They carry more equipment. They're just far better. We can the old ambulances you couldn't even stand up. We can stand up in the ambulances now. We can put people in. Besides the patient, we could put two or three other people in them. We have two ambulances in Concord, and they're rotated out every 5 years. We get a new one every 5 years, so we just keep rotating the equipment through. So we have a paramedic service. The way we do it in this area is it's a hospital-based paramedic service. A lot of people are confused over emergency medical technicians and paramedics. Emergency medical technicians are, it's a general term for ambulance, people who work in the ambulance. All of the members of the Concord Fire Department, including the chief and the deputy, are EMTs. We're all EMTs. We don't all work on the ambulance. The paramedics are the highest trained EMTs. They can administer drugs. They can put airways in people. They can do more things that the basic EMTs can do. It's a service right now. They work with Emerson Hospital. It's a private contractor. It's called Professional Ambulance. They provide the paramedic service to area towns around Emerson Hospital. So we bring our ambulance, we bring a fire truck to a medical emergency. If the protocol calls for the paramedics, they'll be dispatched by our dispatcher, and they meet us at the call. They have a sort of like an SUV vehicle. They put one of the paramedics on board, or both, and they follow us to the hospital. And in conjunction with the advancements, we have defibrillators, which can shock a stopped heart. That's another big change. There's been so many advances as far as emergency medicine in the last 25 or 30 years. It's better than it was before. There used to be an expression, scoop and shoot. They used to just load the people in the ambulance and just drive to the hospital. There wasn't much care given to them. It's all changed now. It's highly technical. It's highly advanced. And people are being medically treated better than they were 30 years ago or 40 years ago.
Did you expect to be involved in emergency medical care?
Well, I knew when I joined that the fire department had the ambulance since the early 50s in Concord, at least. The police used to do the ambulance work. And way, way back, they told me the funeral homes did the ambulance work back in the 30s and 40s. The funeral homes would dispatch an ambulance in town, so that's changed. The police had it for a while, and since, I think, 1952 in Concord, the fire department always did the ambulance work. But when you come into this type of work nowadays, especially in the suburban towns and smaller towns, the fire department, in most cases, does the emergency medical work. If you go into the city, it's a little different arrangement. Boston and the bigger cities and towns around Boston, you might have a private ambulance service. The fire department will go as a sort of an adjunct to them, but it's in most cases the emergency service in Boston's a little different. They have a combined system of health and hospitals ambulances, which is a city service, plus they're supplemented by private ambulance companies who do emergency work. Out this way, it's mostly fire departments. Yeah. So when you come into this, when you do seek a job like this, you know that you will probably, you will be doing emergency medical work. And usually the junior firefighters get assigned to the ambulance. So they're there for like 10, 12 years until they can bid to an engine job or a ladder truck job.
So it's less desirable?
It is, because you're busier. Most of our work now is emergency medicine. We do 75% of our 5,000 runs a year are emergency medicine. We have a lot of healthcare facilities in town. We have nursing homes, assisted living. Population is getting older. A lot goes on in Concord. The Route 2, and it's a busy place. We have a lot of medical emergencies in this town.
I keep wondering about this new, well, not new, but growing right to die movement and living wills and advanced directives, mm-hmm. and I don't necessarily want to be resuscitated, but there you are in a crisis. How do you balance all that?
Well, that's interesting. That's a good question, because if we go to a house and somebody's in cardiac arrest, obviously it's a younger person. We do all we can. We start CPR, we defibrillate them and all that. But if it's an elderly person and they've decided beforehand that they don't want any heroic measures, there's a DNR, do not resuscitate order, in place. And it has to be current, it has to be updated from time to time by the person's physician. And if a family member's there and somebody's in cardiac arrest and they're elderly or they were a hospice patient, we need to see this DNR order, do not resuscitate. And if it's current, then we won't do any life-saving measures. We allow the person to die with dignity. But if we don't find that, we have to, if we're called to the scene, we have to do what we can and transport them. But that's the nice part about those do not resuscitate orders. If they're current, it allows us not to to let the wishes of the person and the family be carried out.
So someone basically has to hand that to you at the time?
Yeah, it's usually kept in the house, and sometimes they're not updated, and they have to be updated and kept current by a physician. I think it's 6 months. I'm not entirely sure on that, but it has to be a current one. They do expire after a certain time. Some of the public doesn't realize, they don't know that, and they're surprised sometimes when they say, well, we had one. They said, but you can't find it, or it's not current. We have to at least attempt to resuscitate the person.
So you will actually look for something in that crisis?
Yeah, we do. It's usually posted in a place where they keep their medications, or a common place in the house, but it can become a problem if it isn't a current one.
Sticky.
Yeah.
Did I let you go where you wanted to go on your next?
Yeah, no, we're doing good here. One of the interesting things that happened in 2007 is we got a federal SAFER grant. And what that is, it's a grant we were allowed to...
Federal...
SAFER, S-A-F-E-R. It's, I don't know whether it was from Homeland Security or FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, but it was federal money that was given to the town to add 4 new firefighters, which we did. It's a graduated... program where you're initially given money from the federal government, and it becomes less and less over 5 years, and allows you to sort of ease into adding new personnel and preparing a budget over time. We added 4 firefighters, one for each group. We have 4 groups in the fire department. That was the first time we added people since the early 1950s. And we have about 5 times as many emergencies as they did back then. So we were operating for years with the same amount of firefighters as they had in the early to mid-50s. And many of the fire chiefs over the years have requested more personnel. They wanted more personnel, and we finally got it. So we have we went from 8 full-time firefighters on duty to 9. And... it was a long time in coming.
Do you look within the realms of conquered residents when you do that?
No. It used to be that they used to hire right from the call department. The call firefighters were the, given the first selection. But because that's not possible now, they go on the outside. They advertise and we're not a civil service department. They do it themselves. So most of the firefighters are hired now are from other departments that want to come to Concord. Concord is considered a desirable fire department to work for. So
then they move here?
Well, no. That's the other thing. It's very difficult for a firefighter to buy a house in Concord. I was the last firefighter hired in 1979. We had to live in town back then. If you were hired by the fire department, you had to live in town. You had to move within a year. And I was living in Concord at the time, but everybody after me did not have to live in Concord. They established a radius. At first, it was 15 miles, and now it's grown to 35 miles border to border. So we have some of our firefighters live so far away. But because of the schedule, it can be done. We work 24-hour shifts. We work a 24-hour shift. We have 24 hours off. Work another 24-hour shift, and we have 5 days off. Most of the fire departments, if about 95% of them, do a 24-hour shift. So you work 24 on, 24 off, 24 on, 5 days off. So you squeeze in 48 hours in a 72-hour period. Most everybody in the fire service likes that type of schedule. I'm one of the very few that doesn't like it. But I only have a week and a half to go, so...
And you don't like it because
we're a busy department. We're up, most of the nights. Just again, we don't fight fires all the time. That's not that, but we go out on medical emergencies and alarms. For somebody my age, it's catching up with me. I'm a captain. I really don't. We were allowed to sleep down there. I never really get into deep sleep because I have to make decisions. You have to be aware of what's going on, but this is where the fire service has moved into 24-hour shifts for full-time departments.
And so, why was there a residency requirement, and why not now?
Well, the residency requirement was because if you were living in town, you could get back to the stations because if we have a fire, we call back all personnel off. We requested they come back in through a series of, I have a pager here, an alpha pager, and we have mini tours. It's a small radio.
Alpha pager, did you say?
Alpha pager, yeah. It's kind of an outdated technology now, but if there was a fire right now in Concord, they would alert the off-duty firefighters two ways. They'd go into the computer, send a message over the alpha pager. They would say, striking a box for a fire at, 500 Sudbury Road, and it would just takes maybe 15 seconds. Once they activate it, this would go off. Alpha page would make a little tone, and then there would be a digital message on the screen. In addition to that, we have these small radios called mini tours, it's a radio. It's a two-way. It's a not a two-way radio, but it's a receiver, and they would announce the where the fire is. So that's the request for off-duty firefighters to come back. Back when everyone lived in town, they got a lot more response. But because they saw the reality of full-time firefighters not being able to buy property in Concord because of the high price of housing, they had to change. They had to allow us to live farther and farther away. We have some people that live pretty far away right now.
And you decided to move at some point, you
said? I did. I lived in Concord. I lived in West Concord, and then... when our family started to grow, we decided we couldn't, I just realistically couldn't, afford the type of house that I wanted. So I moved to Littleton in 1986. As far as other changes on the fire stations, we just had our fire station down here on Wall Street renovated as far as the living quarters, the administrative offices, the day room, the kitchen, and it took 9 months to renovate it. It's beautiful. It's the facilities are second to none, and they've changed. They've renovated the West Concord station. It's the 1932 station. They've They've made some nice changes down there. But the only thing, I don't really have a problem with it, that the apparatus areas, the floors, they haven't changed as far as the dimensions of the door and all that. And these stations were built in an area when the apparatus was much, much smaller. So it's very tight as far as where the vehicles are parked in both stations. But as far as the living quarters, they're beautiful.
Why didn't they expand the doors?
Well, they're kind of, in both cases, kind of landlocked. There's an organization called the National Fire Protection Association, and it's a nonprofit organization that tells the fire service where it should be in many different areas as far as training and fire prevention and building new fire stations. And their parameters are that doors and fire stations should be at least 14 feet high, and I don't know the width, but ours don't even come close to that. Our vehicles barely, in the West Concord station, there's about an inch and a half clearance on the mirrors as you leave the door. In Concord, it's a little bit, down here is a little bit better, but it's too bad that where the vehicles are parked couldn't be, but it's not that easy because they'd have to build a whole new station in order to meet the NFPA requirements. So, but for now, we'll have to live with this. But it's very, very tight as far as the apparatus.
And which station are you in?
I'm in the Walden Street station, which is, you know, more current. It's 1960. So it isn't as bad. As far as the changes in the fire service, that those are what I wrote down in my notes.
I wanted to ask you about the overall emergency plan for Concord. Isn't there a fairly recently established overall emergency plan, and how are the fire departments connected with other emergency services, and is there an overall sense in other words, there's been some proactive planning along these lines to coordinate
neighborhood work.
Yeah, there is. I'm not involved in that. The fire chief is also the emergency management planner, and Steve Kelsey is the assistant emergency management planner. Marty Powers is also involved in that too. And what the emergency management, if there's a crisis in town like a flooding like we had last year, different town departments, they meet in the emergency operations center, which is in the fire station. And it involves the police chief and the fire chief, the deputy fire chief, certain police personnel, Steve Kelsey, various town department heads, and they all meet in the communication center. And if there's a crisis like a flooding or an unusually big storm or something like that, a hurricane, they meet. They've been very proactive in the last several years about getting that more organized, more formalized. I'm not actively involved in that. I have sat in a couple of the meetings for smaller type things like blizzards and things like that. But it's a group of people that get together when there is a crisis or a potential crisis, and they plan out what they need. It involves all town agencies and public safety and Concord Emergency Management Agency. It's called CEMA. It's sort of like a cousin to the Massachusetts MEMA. When this emergency...
CEMA,
Concord Emergency Management Agency. The state has a similar one, MEMA. And they talk to each other. If there's during the flooding last year in March of 2010, the Massachusetts MEMA was activated. They talk with all the different town emergency management people. So it's a well-coordinated organization. As far as the fire service, we have mutual aid. It's very well organized. We have we can request mutual aid for ambulances, for fire, for brush fires. The state has a very sophisticated hazardous materials response. The state is divided into different districts for different things. For hazardous materials incident, the six hazardous materials districts, and there's resources housed in certain fire stations. Many of the firefighters in the state, you know, we have two in our department that are hazmat technicians, and there's a hazmat spill or something like that, they go through a series of notifications through Alpha Pages radios, cell phones. They get those people to come. If they happen to be off duty, they go to where these vehicles, hazmat trucks are housed. They're usually housed, they're sponsored by certain fire departments, and they go and get them. So there's a sophisticated system in place for hazardous materials incidents, hazmats. There's a large brush fire, very large brush fire in Uxbridge about 3 weeks ago. There's task forces in place that are made up of different fire departments, again in regions. They'll activate the closest region to where the emergency is, and they'll pull resources from the fire departments there. So, on a day-to-day basis, if our ambulance was tied up or they went into Boston, we needed another ambulance. We have mutual aid from all this area towns around Lincoln, Acton, Bedford, Carlisle, Sudbury. We get their ambulance in here. So mutual aid is a big part of the fire service. We couldn't operate without it. And it's all in place. We have a working fire right now, let's say in Concord Center. We would have the two stations from our department respond. And we would have, they would be automatically called, like it would be Lincoln and Bedford would come, but they would send an engine company. So we would have four engine companies on scene initially, our ladder truck. And if we needed to go to second alarm, we just keep adding more mutual aid. So it's a good system. It's all in place. We don't have to think about what we have to do. Our dispatchers, they notify people by radio. So it's a good system.
It'd be nice to hear you talk about certain key fires or other emergencies that stay in your mind.
Well, there have been quite a few over the years. I'd say my most memorable one, because there's a couple of very tragic ones, but the most memorable fire or fires happened in December of 1989. We had 2 3-alarm fires that night. I had just got into work. We had a fire very close to the library here on Sudbury Road. It was very cold that night. It got down to about 13, 14 below zero. First fire was in a house right here on Sudbury Road. We were there. It was bitterly cold. It didn't burn the house down. The house was still there. It had to be renovated. But we were there until about 1 o'clock in the morning. The fire came in about 5:30 at night. We were there until about 1 o'clock in the morning. We got everything back as best we could in the station. There was a lot of ice on the trucks. I remember at the time, again, Captain Bob Robinson, he was my captain that night. And he said that the ladder truck had all ice chunks on it. He said, as far as I'm concerned, that truck's out of service unless it melts overnight. So we went to bed. That was about 1:30. At about 4 o'clock in the morning, the dispatcher alerted us. The house lights went on. He said, I got a house on Fairhaven Hill Road that's fully involved in fire. So we headed up there, and again, it was a huge house on Fairhaven Hill. There's no town water up there. Very hard to find. It's a very remote area. There are a lot of beautiful old homes, but they're all very down narrow driveways. We got there, and the house was about 75% involved in fire. The folks got out okay. There was a fire hydrant down on Arena Terrace near Route 2.
Where?
On Arena Terrace. And it's right off of Route 2. Fairhaven Hill Road is a private neighborhood. We tried to get some hose up there. We had a hose wagon from the town of Boxford carries over a mile of hose on it. But by the time we got the hose in place from the hydrant down there, the house had burned completely down. It was 13 below zero. And that was the longest night I can remember in the fire department. We got back to the station about 10 o'clock in the morning. And It was the longest night in the fire department I ever had.
Outline it a little bit. What was going on during all those hours?
Well, we were trying to get some type of water supply established. We brought in a couple of tanker trucks. I believe Carlisle had a tanker truck, because that town has no water, so they carry large amounts of water. There's not much we could do. If you don't have a good, reliable water source right away, if the fire gets a head start on you, there's very little you can do unless you have a sustained water supply. We carry water on the trucks, but only 750 gallons. And it just took too long to get that hose, the water up there. And the hydrant was frozen. So we had everything going against us that night. The location of the house, the frozen hydrant, the weather, it was just, I just remember it was just so cold. And, you know, unlike the fire down here on Sudbury Road the same night, we had plenty of hydrants, plenty of water supply. That had a better, you know, outcome than this one. Those two things stood out the most as far as fires. As far as medical emergencies, a very tragic thing I remember, I was only on the job 1 month as a full-time firefighter. It was early in the night, and we were called to go to Lincoln, town of Lincoln. And what it was is a car had just left the fire station. It was a gentleman. He was a scout leader. He was brought them down the fire station to have the firefighters down there, three scouts, teach first aid and CPR to these kids. They were probably 14 years old. They finished their first aid class, and it was a brand new Saab, and he left the fire station to bring the boys home, and something happened to the car. The accelerator stuck. As it turned out, I had to make a deposition in court, you know, about a year later. But what happened was something happened to the car. It was a defective accelerator. He couldn't stop the car. He hit a tree on Codman Road in Lincoln. They figured he was doing about 68 to 70 miles an hour. And all three scouts were killed. And the driver survived. But we went over there. We took one of the scouts, and we took the driver of the car in our ambulance. Lincoln had already left with two of the other scouts. We brought them to Emerson Hospital, but none of the three boys survived. It was, that's probably the most vivid memory I have, because they were in the scout uniforms, and it was just a terrible night. I'll never forget it.
It seems awfully hard to be the one who's supposed to keep functioning when all your emotions must be flowing.
It you do. You have to kind of it's something that you don't. I've learned over the years is to you have to keep your emotions down, because we're the ones that are called to help people out. And if you get your emotions caught up, you can't function as well. And it's something I've had to learn. It hasn't always been that easy for me. And it takes time. Sometimes death, and sometimes it's a very grim type of thing. It's many times what the public doesn't see. But we're called to do it, so we have to do it, and you have to kind of have to detach yourself from it at the same time, do your job, and that's not always easy.
Does it catch up with you when you have time to rest?
It does, and it has over the years. And there's a network in place to help public safety people. There's a place up in Gardner, Massachusetts called the Onsite Academy. And it was created to deal with people who have sort of like this the syndrome of the soldiers in combat. It's for firefighters and police who
PTSD.
Exactly.
PTSD.
Or PT.
PTSD. Yes, and it's.
Can you say that? Can you say the PTSD?
Put
in a sentence or
something. Post-traumatic stress disorder?
It's post-traumatic stress disorder. And they've recognized that police and firefighters do have problems after they see an unusually grim or difficult scene. And there's people that are trained. to either come to your fire station, or if it's an acute case, an individual has to go to academy, to the on-site academy, they can spend some time there and deal with counselors. We've used it in Concord. We've used it very recently. Right on the Acton-Concord line, just about a week and a half ago, there was a very tragic accident. A man was outside his truck on Route 2. It was during sunset because the driver of the other car had solar blindness, solar glare, and she hit. He was outside his truck securing a load, and unfortunately she hit him and she killed him. And it was a very bad scene as far as the trauma of the body and the firefighters that were there. They were affected by it, so they had a post-incident debriefing. They invite everybody back that was at the scene to meet with these folks that are trained. Again, a lot of them are firefighters and officers in the public safety sector, police and firefighters. Sometimes they're people from the clergy. I've sat in one with a call firefighter from the town of Georgetown. He's also a minister. He was a congregational minister. And that was several years ago. That was for a suicide we had. A woman stepped in front of a train behind Walden Pond. And, I was the captain, but the other firefighters in my group, they said, oh, we don't need this, but I needed it. So I invited everybody that was on the group. And said, you can sit in. You don't have to participate. But it was just such a traumatic thing to see. I felt as though I needed it, being the shift commander. So.
Good for you. That's kind of gutsy.
Yeah, it's some of them are just so detached from it, but this was an unusually tragic because there was a little history behind it. This woman had gone to see her counselor that day, and it wasn't a good meeting, and so she went to Walden Pond and stepped in front of the train. Anyway, those are the ones you don't forget. We've had the suicides are especially tough, and most of the time the younger people, and they're very tough because in a couple of cases they're outside again on public way in front of a train, but most of the time they're in homes and the families find them, and that's. You're walking into a house where they've called for help, and it's almost surreal to see this type of the family members are there. Somebody is taking their life, and it's that's probably the most difficult part of being a firefighter or a police officer. I can't speak for police, of course, but for firefighters, we see these things and to deal with it. But fortunately, there's a network in place to help us out with our feelings and how we cope with it. So the people that do it are well trained too. So that's kind of comforting to know that there's a safety net in place for us too.
So unless the firefighter is clearly experiencing ongoing trauma, you just have the one group session.
Most of the time, it's one group session. If it continues, sometimes it's an accumulative effect that somebody has seen several things. If the person's willing to go to this, on-site academy, as they call it, they'll arrange for them to go there.
And work time?
Yes, they'll make the time available to them, yes.
You might, if you didn't know the situation, looking at it from the outside, you might suppose that there was a lot of macho attitude among firemen that would discourage... Right. Participation in this
that
kind of...
It still exists. It's still there.
What are we talking about?
We're talking about seeing something as far as a tragic scene, something that is unusually difficult, and the firefighters not acknowledging that they might need help. And that's something that the supervisors have to deal with. They have to see it. In a couple of cases, the fire chief... insisted that the group that had the bad incident do go through the post-incident stress debriefing, even though some of them did not want to do it. I've run into a couple in that way. It's a couple of people in my group that they don't seem to be affected by this. They said, unless it was my family, it doesn't bother me. But you can't, I think you can't ignore that, because I think they're suppressing their feelings. And I've read where an accumulation of many tragic things over time takes a toll on a public safety responder. And you have to recognize that. You know, we're not psychologists, that's why they usually an unusually bad incident. Most of the time, we have a post-incident debriefing session. They make it available to the firefighters.
As Michael says, it does seem challenging, and you were saying it sounds like they almost fight you on that.
Yeah, there's resistance. It's what Michael was saying. It's the macho thing. It's men can't always admit that they're feeling something, and you have to recognize that and at least make it available to them, make help available to them. But it is that macho thing is still there. It may be not as pronounced as it used to be, but I feel it's still there, in my opinion.
And yet, I mean, you're a firefighter too. Theoretically, you would be on the same side of the fence, and you're called to a trade that requires a lot of maybe machismo. I don't know. But
yeah, I mean, it is. It's an interesting combination. We do things. You know, that require a lot of force and strength and all that, but at the same time we're dealing with emotions of people, and it isn't always easy to combine the two and deal with something successfully.
Talk about that in your role as a captain.
Well, yeah, as a captain, I'm a ship supervisor. I supervise 8 people. There's 9 people in a group, each group, and most of our stuff is routine. The alarms, the medical emergencies, a lot of our stuff is routine. I worked yesterday. We had we had medical emergencies. We had a couple of routine calls with alarms and all that. But as a shift supervisor, we live together. We eat together. We bunk in the station together. It's a family, and many of the problems in the fire service, among the personnel, among the firefighters, are not because of problems on the fire ground or medical emergencies. It's things that happen within the station, and if you're around somebody that often, sometimes everybody does get along, we live with each other for 24 hours, and their problems come up from time to time, and the fire academies don't teach certain things about how to be nice to each other most of the time, and sometimes the kidding can be taken too far, the joking and among each other, and you have to know when you've reached that line. And as a shift supervisor, we have training on sexual harassment and treatment of people, making fun of people, and creating a good work environment. One of the key words nowadays is a hostile work environment. We have to prevent that from happening. As a supervisor, if you see it and it's under your watch and you don't do anything about it, we can be held responsible for the problem. So this town is very good in that respect. Concord is very good. They have training that they provide us from time to time on different things. And as far as workplace, the workplace environment.
The shift supervisors are trained?
Yes, everyone is. Everyone is. They bring in an expert in workplace environment. And each group, we have 4 groups in the fire department. Each group is trained, and the same for the police. The officers are held to a higher standard than the firefighters, because if they see something, it's their duty to do something about it. They can't let it go. They can't ignore it. Even though they didn't cause it, if you see it, you have to do something about it. It's not tolerated anymore. It's in the past, they may have said, well, that's just, boys will be boys. That's not the way it's done anymore. And we're held to a higher, the officers are held to a higher standard. We have to see it and recognize it and do something about it.
How do you train a group of people to be nice?
Well,
to work together.
That's not that easy. I've always, my philosophy is I try to lead by example. As a shift supervisor, I try not. I'm not supposed to be doing, you know, washing vehicles, cleaning station, but I do. I participate in those things because I've often held that I'm not going to ask anybody on my shift to do something that I'm not willing to do. So sometimes that does, you know, the previous fire chief didn't like me doing things, but he finally accepted the fact that if I wasn't going to do it during the day shift, I was going to do it on the night shift when he went home. So, but. I think leading by example as a ship supervisor, as an officer, whether you're a lieutenant or captain, is with the type of people that we are and what we do, it's probably the best, in my opinion, it's the best way to teach people.
Well, I sort of wondered how the whole work ethic thing works out. I mean, obviously people come to the job with a different sense of ethics, and you're sleeping some of the times officially. I mean,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
How does
it's
that
a, well, you, again, we have, you know, we have 36 firefighters in the whole department. We have four groups of nine. You have 36 different opinions on a lot of things. It's very hard to. And the groups develop their own identity. We have four groups. They each have their own identity. And the personnel, over time, will try to seek out, as an opening becomes available because of retirement or whatever, if they feel as though they work better with another group, they'll try to bid for that position. We have, through our contract, we have bid positions. And I'll tell you, it's over the years, the groups of my group has a certain identity as opposed to on group two, and group one has a different identity. And it's just the way it works out. And I think it's pretty universal in the fire service. They people find their own comfort zone.
Different identities.
Yeah, there's our group is known as a very quiet, serious group. Not serious, but and there's another group that's they're just, you know, they're constantly joking and, you know, bantering with each other. And then there's it is. It's a we're doing the same thing, but there's just there's different personalities.
Are there official times of day when there aren't emergencies, when you're to work and when
yes,
you're to have
yeah,
leisure?
We have a definite schedule. We have a we do a roll call in the morning. We start our shifts at 8 o'clock officially. We get in earlier, about 7:15, 7:30. We do roll calls.
You get in 45 minutes before you need to?
Yeah, we do. Because most firefighters, they come in the civilian clothes, they change into their uniforms in the station. So it's a little time to and then you ask the other group what happened during, you know, the overnight shift or your 24-hour shift. So we start at 8 o'clock, we have a roll call, and we have certain things we have to do in the morning. For the first hour and a half or 2 hours, we have to check the vehicles, make sure everything is, you know, has fuel in it, there's water, the ambulance is equipped properly. Then we have house duties. We have, you know, we clean the station. And then there's usually training done every day. And then if something, you know, emergency comes up, you have to go on the emergency. Then you come back and you know, finish what you were doing. There is a routine. Certain days, or we check certain vehicles. Like yesterday, we checked the two brush fire trucks. There's one at each station, the smaller trucks. Wednesday is check engine 5 and engine 6. So that was usually Monday is check the two main pumpers. Tuesday is to check the reserve pumpers. Wednesday is do the brush trucks. Thursday is check the ladder truck, and Friday is check the ambulances. So this is a routine. There's a schedule for everything. So. You know, lunch hour from 12 to 1, you know, if we have an emergency in the middle of it, we just leave. Of course, incidents take precedence. You just leave whenever you have. But there's a certain schedule. We're allowed to go into the bunk rooms at 10 o'clock at night, not before. And
Not before. So you're working till 10?
Well, you're up. You're not necessarily working, but... you're not allowed to retire until 10 o'clock at night.
When can you start playing cards?
We don't play cards.
No?
No, I've been on 34 years. I've never seen a card game in the fire station.
What do people do?
They, there's, you know, television and there's some misconceptions about the fire station. We don't have a pool table. We don't. I've never seen a card game. There's always something to do. I find, you know, I'm the overtime coordinator. We have a lot of overtime. I hire the people off duty. There's a training officer. We have an equipment officer. There's specialists. We have two emergency medical coordinators that take care of the ambulances and all the training for that. We have radio specialists. We have all kinds of specialists. We have computer specialists. There's all types of work to be done. It's a different type of job than a lot of people perceive. There's no card game playing. There's no shooting pool. There is some downtime. I admit, you know, the television is we're only allowed to watch TV on weekends. Okay, at night. After 5 o'clock, not during the day at all, television is not on, at least in Concord. It may be different in other towns, but not in Concord. We do have some traditions down there as far as rules. So
from 5 on?
Yeah, 5 on. It's really your own time, but usually the officers have something to do. I'm hiring people. Overtime is a big part of the job down there, so I'm doing a lot of hiring. You call people off duty, and there's different shifts and different details, and so it's a busy place.
Overtime.
The way we're set up, as far as overtime in the fire department, we have 9 firefighters on a shift. We can go down 1 firefighter. If a firefighter's off on vacation or sick or personal, whatever, we can go down to 8. And what we do, we always keep 3 firefighters in the West Concord station. We always keep five firefighters downtown. But if there's one off, we have to hire. And that happens quite often. And you have to try to get somebody off duty. We work 24-hour shifts. The most somebody can work is 48 hours in a row. You can't work beyond 48 hours, according to our contract. 48 hours. In other words, if you're on your second 24-hour shift and there's an overtime available, if it's another 24-hour shift, you can work that. You cannot work in between your two 24-hour days. You can only work either the day shift or the night shift. You can't work at all because that would be 72 hours, and that's not allowed. So you can only work up to 48 hours in a row. So we hire for example, there was a lot of times you take 4 hours off, and those have to be covered. So you try to find somebody in that rank off duty to work 4 hours. We have special details for like Fence School, their private school. They'll have a football game. They'll need an EMT on scene, so we'll hire for that. Lots of things like that. Welding details in certain buildings in town. They'll need a fire watch. We'll hire for 4 or 5 hours. Always an off-duty person. You can't touch the duty crew, but it's always off-duty personnel.
And that's a different pay scale?
It's time and a half. You get time and a half, and you get minimum of 4 hours. Even if it might be a 2-hour detail, you get 4 hours. Again, that's a union contract has been bargained for that.
Union.
We're union. Yes, we are. We belong to the International Association of Firefighters. That's a federal, it's a national organization, IAFF. It's been around for years. And we're also members of the PFFM, Professional Firefighters of Massachusetts. Obviously, it's a Massachusetts-based organization. So it's really two unions we belong to. We pay dues to them.
What's the state one again?
State one is PFFM. Professional Firefighters of Massachusetts.
Is the other one part of a larger union?
International. It's part of unions in the United States and Canada.
Just firefighters.
Just firefighters. The police have their own. They have their own unions, but the IAFF is the international. It's made up of U.S. and Canada, and the PFFM is Massachusetts. And there's other state union organizations too, and the different states. But we belong to those two.
Talk about their history?
Well, I'm not sure when they started. They assist firefighters as far as, you know, in their collective bargaining, their benefits. They assist in when firefighters die in the line of action. They offer their services in organizing the funerals. They played a huge part in New York City during the World Trade Center, that incident. And then the PFFM and the International played a big part in the 1999 fire in Worcester when they lost the 6 firefighters. They helped to organize. They kind of bring everything together. But the biggest function is in your collective bargaining, you know, getting the benefits that they feel as though you should need as far as salary and benefits and wages.
Have there been any exciting incidents in the collective bargaining?
No, not really. We have a contract. We're negotiating right now. They're almost done. Yeah, we do it every 3 years. And it's, for the most part, dealing with the town of Concord is pretty good. They take care of us. Concord is a good town to work for. And there might be some little bumps along the road, but basically, working for Concord is a great town to work for. And I don't recall anything unusual. Way, way back when I was on the call department, there was a move to combine the police and fire departments into a public safety department, consolidation, and it wasn't popular with either the police or the fire. That never really got off the ground. And so the department stayed separately, but they did bring in the international people for that from Washington to try to, you know, convince the town that that wasn't a good idea, and that never really got off the ground.
Well, here you are on the brink of some changes for yourself. How did they get lined up?
As far as my retirement, yeah. Well, you can retire at age 30, at 32 years of service and 55, and of course I've met that. I've been thinking about it, and I do have some health issues. I'm type 2 diabetic, it was time. You kind of know when you're ready. I'm having, I guess I know it's sleep deprivation, and it hasn't gotten any better over the years. So it's just something I've always had to deal with. But it occurred to me that before I have a medical event or something like that, I should retire while I'm relatively healthy, and I've got all my time in. And there's been some changes in my family as far as we take care of our grandson. And my son and his wife have another child along the way, so we take care of my grandson a couple of days a week. My wife recently started another job. She's a nurse at Emerson Hospital. She had her hip replaced, so she can't do floor work, so she's going to go to work for a physician in an office. So that her schedule makes it more important that one of us be around to take care of our grandson. Like I said earlier, my son is a firefighter in Lincoln. His wife is a nurse, so the schedules are really kind of difficult. So this is the right time. I had to go at age 65. I'll be 62 in the last day of May, so I can't add to my pension. I've maxed out. So it's the right time. It's the right time. I'm ready.
How's it feel?
It's a little strange. It's a little mixed feelings. My group took me out to dinner a couple weeks ago at the Wayside Inn, and we're a really close group, and it was a really nice night, and I'm going to miss them, and they're a great group of guys to work for. It's a little strange because this is, you know, all I've known for the last, you know, 34 years, and to just suddenly not, you know, not go in, even the 2 24-hour shifts, it's going to be different, but that's just something I have to learn. I've talked to other retirees, and they said it's the best. They said you'll love it once you get into the groove of retirement. So, but I've got a couple of other little part-time job offers. through family, so we'll have to weigh those out. But for the next couple of months, I think I'll just sort of sit back and see what it's like.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoyed this all.
Is there any